Learning is a social process. It is not only an individual process. So moving from individual to cognitive, to social and experiential, then we have a four dimensions of the learning.
This is What Now, the latest in the Ludic Insights podcast series hosted by Paul Ashcroft and Garrick Jones, partners and co-founders of Ludic and the co-authors of the best-selling books Alive, Digital Humans and Their Organizations, and The Curious Advantage.
Hello and welcome to the What Now? Ludic Insights Podcast Series 2. This series focuses on exploring the most influential perspectives and conversations on the current and future trends that are affecting the way we live, work and learn. What now, since the huge pivot to digital and as a result of the global pandemic? What now for individuals, society and business? What now for healthcare, education, finance, energy, marketing, travel, aerospace, manufacturing, technology? What now in the multiverse and the omnichannels and the inspiring, incredible, astonishing story of being human in the 21st century? To question is the answer. My name is Paul Ashcroft.
And my name is Garrick Jones. Paul and I are partners of the Ludic Group. In this episode, we are delighted to welcome Alpa Utko. Hello, Alpa.
Hi, Paul, Garrick. Very nice to be with you today.
We're delighted you could join us. Let me give a little introduction. Lead of the European Leadership University in the Netherlands, which is a next generation university built to respond to the growing tech skills gap by developing job-ready talent for exceptional organizations. And you focus on developing talent in highly sought tech roles, such as AI, machine learning, data science, and software engineering. The university's innovative full-stack development model bundles degrees, skills, and jobs, and offers flexible study options to enable reskilling, upskilling for those who want to work and study. Makes it affordable for young talent to study tech thanks to the sponsorship of its employer partners. It's a whole different business model that combines leadership skills with tech skills to develop 360 degree professionals. You have a background in mechanical engineering, leadership, development and organizational change with 30 years experience in skills development. You're the author of two books, Agile Companies, Organizational Consulting, At the Edges of Possibility. And we know each other from some of the think tank work we've been doing together. So absolute delight to have a chat with you today, Alpa.
Thank you, Gary. Can I have the script of this introduction? This is lovely. It's much better than I could have done.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful. It's very kind words and it really summarizes what I do. Yes, it's been a pleasure being with you, and I love your podcast series, What Now? We're bringing, you know, great ideas, great minds, great inspiration to us.
But that's the idea. We have questions about what's going on right now. We want to know, you know, what's pivoting in the world, what are the trends that are emerging, and what's becoming the new modus operandi. And that's kind of the thinking behind this podcast. Paul?
So Alpa, the series, as you say, is called What Now? So let's start with maybe the hardest or the most open question. What now in your mind?
I think right now in my mind, I'm completely occupied with this big change and transformation that's going on in the world. And it is accelerated with what we see as the pandemic. But there are so many forces coming into play at the same time. And we are seeing it at the society level, at the planetary level, and at, you know, different layers of life. And so it's very, very exciting times and also quite scary at the same time, because there are a lot of unknowns. But yeah, I think embracing the unknown with excitement, I think that makes life worth living. So this is what we are going through, and this is what's on my mind now, almost every day.
Alpa, your focus is transforming education. What are some of the big trends that are emerging in education, and what are you seeing?
Well, I think with the technology transformation, we are seeing a big shift in education. And the traditional educational system is actually built around bringing together the faculty, the teachers, and the students and learners in the same place at the same time because we didn't have any other option. So we built campuses and we created faculties, we created courses, and we designed everything around this time and location based educational system. And that there was nothing wrong with that. Now, with the help of digital technology, I think we are now free from, emancipated from this time and location boundaries. So we can study anywhere, anytime. And that actually gives us a fundamental change opportunity also for education. So because of that design in the educational system, actually, as a, you know, what I've seen as an educational entrepreneur, as a founder of a university, I've realized that universities are more in real estate industry than they are in education industry.
Yeah.
We will talk more about that, but that mandates lots of things in the education design. But at the end of the day, you know, it limits flexibility and it limits affordability. Limits flexibility because you have to be in a certain place, certain time. But also it limits affordability because at least 80% of the tuition that we pay today to universities in different ways are somehow created from that time and location-based cost.
We saw it in the UK, I have to say. Just during the pandemic, lots of kids who were going to university were forced to pay university fees and rental for rental accommodation to stay on campus. And when they got to campus, they were locked into their rooms, and many of them never met anybody. I know two friends, children, who have left their universities because they never met anybody in the first 2 years. One person met one person in all that time, and they paid a lot of money for the privilege, so-called privilege. So that model is broken, isn't it? It's completely fallen down and been shown up.
It is outdated. It's really outdated. It's what brought us today. But it is not necessary anymore. But I think we're seeing lots of universities and government are still sticking to that structure because there is economic reasoning behind that. So bringing these students to a certain location, there's an economical benefit of that, which I understand. But I think we have, you know, the costs of this are much higher than the benefits. Yeah, the second transformation that we are seeing, we should be seeing as well, is the whole, that's same with the business, but also, but more with the education. The whole education is designed with a very engineered, masculine mindset of teaching. So it's one way, it's individual, it's quite cognitive. So that's also, in a way, imposed with that structure, like the time and location-based structure. What can you give in a, you know, when you have like 40 minutes of classroom time, what can you really do there? I mean, because that's all you've got. So that limits that. And we now have the opportunity to move beyond this individual and cognitive base of learning towards social learning, which, you know, you, with your example that not being able to meet anyone. I mean, you should be able to not only meet, but study with people. Because learning is a social process. It is not only an individual process. So moving from individual to cognitive, to social and experiential, then we have a four dimensions of the learning. And we kept missing that in the traditional system, in a brick and mortar education system. And now the digital technology gives us that opportunity too.
Helpy, I heard you talk there about, and I wrote them down as availability, accessibility, affordability, and actually the approach of learning, the approach of education. As you start to talk there about what are some of the things that are going to, we're going to see in the future of education, do you have some specific examples of where you're seeing organizations or institutions do this really well?
Yes, I think we are seeing more and more organizations who is now working with flexible hours, work anywhere policies, remote working. So that's a great, great change. And even the most conservative ones are now mentioning the hybrid. So when I hear hybrid, that means conservative to me.
Oh, that's interesting. Sorry. Just, you see hybrid is conservative. What would you say is
normal?
What should be normal?
Yeah, it's remote. I mean, the remote is the normal. I mean, or work anywhere. I mean,
yeah.
You know, just don't limit that. Yeah, because this is like 100 years old thinking, putting people into brick and mortar places and, you know, making them work 9 to 5. We know that life is not that static, that it's not that linear. I mean, we can work anywhere, anytime, you know, based on our priorities. I have children to pick up from school. That's a time I want to be with my daughter, but then I can work when she is at a whatever class in the evening or doing homework or whatever. So I think we should have this fluid and dynamic sense of work. And same is with the education. So, you know, in my ideal world, when we see progressive companies and progressive educational institutions embracing that dynamic concept, then we can, you know, we don't have to babysit students for 3 years, 4 years, try to find them housing and everything. They can work and study at the same time, and there's nothing better than practicing your learning in a work environment in whatever level. So, and then also that solves the affordability problem.
Alba, thinking of some of the emerging technology trends that we're seeing around education, what are some of those that are top of mind for you?
I think we have a big storm, maybe even tsunami ahead of us. We should all prepare for that, not only educational institutions, any colossal institutions in our society. That is the technological development of distributed ledger technologies, in the popular sense, the blockchain. So, and when you hear blockchain, don't please ever think about what's going to be the price of Bitcoin or anything. You know, this is, I think there is much deeper change that it involves. So, you know, I think we can talk another hour about that, but simply the blockchain makes any institution that provides trust, makes that institution irrelevant in a way. So universities are also providers of trust because they provide credentials.
Yeah, credentials. That's where it's about, isn't it? But does it mean that I, as a learner, could do a guitar course online or could do a pottery course somewhere, but could also do an MBA or a new emergent type of course, and those credentials are on a blockchain record? So it doesn't matter where my learning comes from, but my blockchain record can be taken wherever I go with me. Is that what's coming?
Well, I think that flexibility is number one, but there's even a more fundamental change that's coming. When you study with a university today, and when you graduate, you get a piece of the paper, which we call diploma, which is very valid, but actually, you never get your credential. You get your credential stays with the university. How do we know that? If you want to apply for immigration or for a job or something, if somebody wants to validate your piece of paper, they have to go back all the way to your university to validate that. That means your credential is stored and stays, still is in the ownership of the university, and it can be revoked at any time. You don't have control. But in the blockchain, in this structure, you say, you will have it in your blockchain. You will have the ownership. And that's a big power shift. So I think that power shift is very critical. And it mandates the educational institutions to really question and change their role and how they are organized and what their purpose is. So because they will lose that power as a trust institution. And it's going to be the same for any institution, including banks, which provides that trust and everything. But from the perspective of education, blockchain will be the tsunami. And together with this digital and technology change, where it allows us to work anywhere, study anywhere, learn anywhere, anytime, together with that, it will be a huge change. And I think I would invite educational institutions to really embrace and prepare. I think we already have passed a critical point. If you look at ICOs, initial coin offerings in the educational sense, there are hundreds of very innovative ICOs on the blockchain domain for education. So I think the deep wave is already too big. So I think it's very soon that we're going to see these changes.
So that's tech on the credentializing side. Are there other tech emerging on the content side, for example?
You know, we can still continue on these two trends, like work anywhere, study anywhere, and also credentialing or providing knowledge with the blockchain. That will enable you or us or universities or the learners to bring or create credentials with faculty, you know, distributed faculty, distributed knowledge, rather than kind of fixated faculty structures, static knowledge, curriculums and everything. So it will have much more fluid and adaptive way of learning, as we described, with the help of, you know, AI technologies, which is going to be more commoditized by that time.
I have to ask you about AI technology then. How in practice do you think AI will assist in this delivery? What's going to be going on? How does it impact my experience as a learner?
I think the AI, in the simplest sense, the artificial intelligence or the machine and the algorithm together with the code, will make it very easy for us to search and find and consume different learning experiences from wherever it is at the best time and cost-based parameters. So you will be able to find whatever the learning path you are on, without searching on Google or without doing a lot of preparation or consuming time, you'll be able to access the right set of knowledge for your learning style, for your conditions, or, you know, in terms of time and abilities, very, very easily, at the simplest sense. So coupled with, you know, the distributed sense of learning with the blockchain, it will also make it very favorable for the learner and for the teacher, let's say, or the knowledge provider to meet, because we will, the middleman that we have today will have a totally different meaning. We will not need the middleman anymore. And universities are, sorry to say, as a lineage.
You talked about learning and work, and it's much more impactful if you're learning within the workplace or learning to do things when you need them. Some people call that learning in the flow of work. I've heard about that really for people who are in the workplace already. You think that this should work and could work and does work for young students who are also learning for the first time.
Of course.
Does this build into your model then of having young people working at the same time as learning? How does that play out?
Yes, I mean, our cohort this year started in November with our bachelor programs with artificial intelligence, machine learning, software engineering. We opened the cohort with students from, I think, 40 countries last night. I was so inspired. They are from all over the world, very dynamic, very forward-thinking young people. And lots of them already working, you know, as junior developers, as data analysts in organizations. So in our model, we encourage and also make it possible for the learners to work and study at the same time. This is how the program is designed. And we also embrace their practice to be brought into the curriculum and count toward credits, because that practical application is a strong part of learning in what we believe. It's a part of the experiential learning, taking what you learn to the practice, to your work, to practice. And that's the best way to learn, you know, beyond the theoretical, knowledge-based, cognitive learning.
Alper, you also mentioned the importance of social learning. How does that, in your mind, work where education is becoming more and more remote and work is becoming more and more remote? What are the things we need to put in place, and how do we keep learning social?
Yes. I think I come from the postmodern thinking with my, you know, if you look at my, let's say, academic background, I'm an engineer converted into organizational development consultant with the doctorate. And what I learned with my learning is, I think the mechanical view of organizations, including the educational institutions, are actually coming from the thinking of two mechanical engineers, the Taylor and Ford, and highly influence everything we got. it's got its time. It worked at the time, but now we are in a totally different era. So what we know, an organization is just simply a group of people who are together and having conversations. This is the simplest sense of organization for me. And anything we attribute to an organization as a product, as a headquarters, as a logo, is always a frozen version of some conversations taking at a certain time. So for me, doesn't matter whether it's physical or remote. We've seen with the pandemic that organizations continue without the buildings, without the headquarters, without the branches or whatever, because we continued our conversations in a different form. So for me, a quality of an organization, any organization, whether educational or business, is defined by the quality of its conversations. So how do we enable and engage and encourage these conversations? And that's possible remotely. We are in a conversation right now. And the quality of that conversation is the quality of this podcast. And the same with our university. So if we don't enable the conversation, if you just make it one-way teaching, make it with technology, make it in the campuses, that is not a complete organization in my perspective. So that's how we try to do it remotely.
You make me think about the young people who are playing games and working in, using some of the very sophisticated games engines. And they form teams with people from all over the world. And these teams last for years sometimes. And there's a very strong identity with these teams. And for all intents and purposes, they are real. And these are very real relationships. And yet they may never have met any of these people except within the gaming engine. So it is possible as humans to have social interaction within the gaming space and within the digital space. Do you think it's vital, though, that for learning, we also get together physically with other people? Or do you think the next generation doesn't need that?
I think it's just different mediums. I mean, I will give examples from our learning approach, how we make that possible. It is just a different medium. It's whether you meet in Zoom or whether you meet in a room. I think it's, for me, it's a different take. But I think enabling these relationships and conversations, whatever the circumstances, are critical. So in our learning process, as students are offered these different social environments. So you mentioned about the gamers teams. We structured that into the program as what we call action learning sets, the sets of 4 to 7 people in the cohort. They are brought together in the beginning of the program, and they stay together throughout the program. They are buddies, they learn together. And we used to have that in our traditional university education. I remember my best 4 or 5 friends, we would come together before the midterms and final exams, study at somebody's home or dormitory or whatever. So we formalize this as a one way of social learning, but it doesn't stop here. We also have live workshops, for example, other than the digital learning that is anytime, anywhere, that live workshops create interaction and engagement. We don't teach anything on the live workshops, but we just create sense-making opportunities in an interactive way with the students. So that's the second one. We also have mentors that the students can relate to if they want to, get some wisdom and advice for their practice, learning, to make sense of some of the assignments they do. So they have that. So we encourage all of these learning relationships to be an active part of the learning process. And this is how I see the social learning happens. Yesterday when they asked me an advice to complete the program, I just told them, never walk alone. I mean, you always support someone and be with someone.
You're listening to What Now, the latest in the Ludic Insights podcast series. Follow hashtag What Now on Twitter and LinkedIn.
Elpa, one of the other things you mentioned when we were talking about trends is how I sort of brought together this approach. And you talked about the sort of the masculine, very traditional way of working through a curriculum, working through a set sequence of content The trend, of course, now is more to adaptive. Learning that is adaptive around the individual, whether they need that in their work, whether they need that in the, just the task they're doing next. What's your view on adaptive learning, and where are you seeing that really being applied well?
It's a wonderful question, Paul, because for two reasons. The adaptive learning is important because we now know from theory and practice, people have different learning capabilities and learning preferences. In the traditional system, actually, we marginalize some people with different learning tendencies and with people with disabilities and everything, which is, I think, not the disability of the people, it's the disability of the system. Because the system is only broadcasting knowledge in one single frequency. And if you are out of that frequency, if you have a different learning style, you are called this and that and whatever with disability. But I think the adaptive learning is giving opportunities to learners with different learning abilities and then use their best learning ability in the program. Because some people are reflective. They love to learn things with reflection. Some people are conceptual. Some people are experiential. Some people are practical. So they take, so there are different ways of kind of getting on in and producing knowledge. But the traditional system is highly conceptual. And if you are in the other three dimensions, you're most probably left out of the system. This is why we have so many dropouts.
Yeah.
Not just the content you're talking about there in terms of adaptive learning, but also the learning methods that are being used to deliver learning for individuals.
Absolutely. And we should, even the word content is actually really limiting us to the conceptual learning, one of the learning style, which is not wrong, but it is incomplete. Mm. So we should just take the content to more towards something like learning journey or learning experience, where we can have these four dimensions of learning together. And in a way, you have the option to use your best learning style, but at the same time, you are encouraged to stretch yourself to other learning styles. So that's the diversity and adaptive learning. So that's one side of adaptive learning. The other side of adaptive learning, I would say, is how do you make it applicable, and how do you, you know, adapt what you grasp through your learning journey with your new application of the knowledge and practices that you've got through the education. So that's, to me, also a part of the adaptation in a way. So I take it from two angles, from a structural angle and also from an individual application angle, so the adaptive learning. But yeah, I see like technological advancements like AI machines providing you content based on your interest. Yeah, I think that's adaptive learning, but still very limited to content. I mean, and we have more than content in the learning styles. But that's what I wanted to highlight. Sometimes we repeat some of the mistakes of the traditional system, even with the technology.
Can we talk about us hopefully now coming out of the COVID pandemic? It's, of course, created a sea change, particularly in learning. What are the things that you've seen that you're paying attention to, the big bets that we should be making as we think about transforming learning, transforming education as we now emerge from the pandemic? Where are the opportunities for investment? Where are the real opportunities for growth and for scale?
I think the biggest opportunity, as I mentioned in the beginning of my our conversation, is the, I think, being free from this time and location restrictions in a way. So from an educational perspective, I think any educational institution have the opportunity to be global. So that's, I think, one opportunity. The second opportunity and big bet, but that we are also carrying the flag, something we call full stack education. So the universities are no longer good enough if they only provide courses and certificates or diplomas. I think they should go beyond that. We should go beyond that. We should provide skills next to credentials and jobs next to the diplomas. So that we should just take the whole journey of bringing people to the market, the job market, with full capabilities, the students. So I think to me that's going to be a trend, and universities who will do that beyond their career services.
And presumably that would require that idea, you know, the full stack concept which you're talking about, which is a technology term, of course, that must require partnerships, a number of partnerships from different sectors and different domains, from technology, from education, from the job market, to provide that full stack experience.
Yes, and it's actually much more complicated than it sounds, because we are living with it every day. So if you go beyond our campuses, and if you go beyond the thinking of your regulators and accreditors, you actually go into contact with a new audience of a new generation of accreditors, which are the employers. Employers will tell us, and they tell us now, these are the people that I need. These are the capabilities that I need. And then they will validate your program from an outcomes and competency perspective. And I think the universities then will need to have the courage and the flexibility to create and adapt their programs based on the real life situations. This is, you know, this sounds, it makes a lot of sense. This sounds very logical, but it's not as easy as it looks, because you need to constantly adapt. You know, and it's hard for the traditional system because it's very static. I'll give you an example. I will not name the university, but one of our associate faculties work with a top university in the US. They are in the Ivy League and one of the most prestigious universities. And he was telling me that it took us 10 years to bring some data science thinking and its coding into our MBA program. And we finally made it. They brought R language into their MBAs so that they can do work with data. But by that time, R language left its place to Python, and it was already too late. So they need another maybe 10 years to change that program. But what I'm saying is the MBA is already dead. So we don't need MBAs anymore, because MBA is made for the human workers. Now we have our new co-worker, which are machines, and we need a new generation of mastery for people to be able to work with the new co-worker, which is machines, and work with the people who can work with machines. So the traditional MBA is completely dead. I mean, so there's no way of improving that anymore.
Paul and I like to play this game occasionally and about what is the curriculum of the new MBA, and it's not an MBA, of course, as you say, but what is the curriculum? What are the things that you think should be on the should be taught now for young people?
Well, I will make it, I'll try to make it simple without being simplistic, but as I mentioned, it's all about relational capabilities. You know, we talked about learning being social. So relational capabilities is being able to engage into different relationships. So what are the relationships that we need to engage at the moment? I think we need to engage with machines, the code and algorithms. That is the number one skill. We need to be able to engage with ourselves. So that's the number two skill. We need to be able to engage with other people at a one-to-one level. So the skills like communication, coaching, this kind of, we need to be able to engage with teams, and we need to be able to engage with organizations. I think these five level of engagements are the definition of the universal person that universities should now aspire to develop. So any curriculum that is providing that, to me, I think is an up-to-date curriculum for today.
Could I add civil society on that?
I think you should add, and this is what I say is actually can be taken two levels further. So engaging with the society and community, and engaging with the planet.
Yeah.
So I hope we'll catch up with my already outdated five levels of engagement.
You get two more, exactly. The society, because we want people to vote and use democracy for powerful purposes and shift the game, and engage with the planet because there's a job to be done there.
Exactly, because it's being aware that we are living in this world together with human and non-human the ways of living. So I think
I love your curriculum. I love your curriculum from an engagement perspective. That model: who do I engage with as a full human reaching my full potential? Just brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I can kind of voice it here with your, I think, very inspiring question. Thank you to Paul and Gary.
Alpro, I wanted to ask if you had a crystal ball and if you could gaze into your crystal ball, to think about what might be the tipping points that tip us into this new world of where education is stored in a distributed ledger, where the trust we maintain with our organizations to provide education is actually now through technology. It took a global pandemic to shift us to hybrid, to remote working, to something that many people have been doing for a long, long time. But for this to become mainstream, it took a global pandemic. What do you think might be the tipping points that tip us and universities into this sort of blockchain-based distributed store of our learning?
Well, I think we've already crossed the tipping point with the pandemic. I'm very, very happy that I'm unfortunate, you know, about that tipping point, you know, despite my sadness of, you know, lives and the health of many of us impacted with that. But, at the, you know, there is the brighter side of this pandemic has been, you know, it forced us to change that should have happened much earlier. I think we will have societal changes growing examples of seeing this kind of learning opportunities, as we have seen in the past with different learning providers like, you know, Udemy and Coursera. And to me, they are still the old school platforms. But, you know, how we've seen that change happening, you know, easy to access, you know, affordable, high quality learning experiences. We will see that, you know, on the way, and, you know, after a while it will, I'm hoping that we will see with the job opportunities, with the flexibilities, the quality of life, you know, embedded into these examples will encourage more and more people to move away from the traditional learning system. We talk about the great resignation today. So we are seeing people moving away from traditional as somehow oppressive work environments. And we will see the same, let's say, resignation from the traditional education system.
Mm.
Because educational system, it had another quality. One is the real estate. We talked about it. This is now gone. We don't need that. The second is, The universities have been in the mobility business, so they were selling visas attached to diplomas. We have to face that.
Mm.
So you want to have a better life, you live in Bangalore, but you want to go to UK, and the best way toward this life is to get the UK university because it's bundled with a visa.
Yeah.
In the future, we will not need that visa because we can work anywhere for a UK employer without leaving my hometown or my parents or my family, my friends, whatever. That is also going to be possible, and it will be even much more impactful with changes like blockchain, because I will be compensated in a much better way for the whatever the qualities and capabilities that I'm bringing with that. So that will happen with that resignation from another traditional system.
That's the other thing. What this is doing, the global connection between everybody, whether it's for learning or work or so on, is also normalizing compensation, I think, around the world. And so that arbitrage between, you know, low-paid developing countries and so on, that's changing rapidly. As people get paid and recompensated for the work they do.
The threat that I see in the world after the security, global security and climate change, is the immigration. Because of these two dynamics, people are forced to leave their home countries.
Mm.
And that is creating a lot of social and economic instabilities in their countries and in the other countries, like from people from Africa to Europe, or from Mexico to US. or Venezuela to Mexico, all these, or Bangladesh to India.
I saw recently 25% of immigration is prompted by war and instability, but 75% is economic migration.
And even the wars are because of economic conditions. I mean, yeah. The wars do just because, you know, some people are not happy with their. So it is at least 75%, if not more. So if you can bring economic prosperity without having to move your hometown, move from out of your hometown, we see it already. Like, you cannot get a Romanian developer to Netherlands because they can do what they do in Romania without leaving the country right now. And Romania is a wonderful place to live. It's much less costlier, and people just love to be there. And we'll see that. We'll see people working, still living in Kenya and doing work for, I don't know, UK out of Kenya. And then, you know, the UK employers maybe will pay a little bit less than UK salaries, but much more than Kenyan salaries.
Yeah.
And it will bring economic prosperity to Kenya or Nigeria or Rwanda or in Nepal. You know, we see that.
Yeah.
I mean, one of our students, I'll tell you a story. One of our students in our first data science cohort, he got a job offer from an American company as a data scientist. And he would tell me, when his mother learned the salary that he was getting, which was like a fraction of the salary that they would pay in Silicon Valley, she had cried. Mm. It was such a huge, big difference.
Yeah.
Can you imagine this happening at a scale? And
it's happening already, I think. Already, yes. We see in India, the shift in wages in the call centers and that has gone one direction.
So my answer to your question, Paul, in my crystal ball, I'm an optimist, and I'm dreaming of a world where, you know, the education is affordable, it's for everyone, it's flexible, and people do not have to leave their countries just for work, leave their families just for work, and the prosperity is evenly distributed around the world. With all these limitations that we had in the past, when we didn't have the technology and capabilities. So I want that. And also because of that concentration of the time and location where we are concentrated in the metropolitan cities, we will see also much more peaceful engagement with the planet, where we will have less detrimental human structures, human establishments. With all that flexibility. That's my dream.
Do you have a question for us?
Yeah, I think my question for you and for all the listeners is, well, I have two questions. First question is, what has emerged in that conversation for you, in your mind, as idea, as thoughts, as emotion? That's my first question.
I mean, I loved so much of what you've talked about, and agree with very much of it. I particularly resonated the way you talked about adaptive learning and really thinking broadly about how we deliver learning for learners and beyond just content and matching content in a very technical way, but really thinking the human aspect of how we approach learning so that it is, as you say, accessible for as many people as possible. So I think that was one of my favorite things that you talked about.
I love it.
The thing that really has made me think is this understanding of each individual as a learner, as a whole person. When we asked about the curriculum, your approach was to start from what do we connect with? What do we engage with? We engage with the planet. We engage with civil society. We engage with ourselves. We engage with other people. We engage with teams. We engage with organizations. For me, that is a huge pivot point, because if the starting point is what do we as human beings engage with and what are the skills that enable that, that immediately shifts how we create curricula for this coming epoch, if you like, things that have shifted since we needed education for the factories and factory work. So thank you very much for that. That's been fascinating.
Thank you. And I think my final question, which I'm not asking you to answer that, but for all of us, is with the awareness and knowledge of all this change, what can we do as individuals for a better world ahead of us that is much more inclusive and livable for all the human and non-human living?
Alpo, thank you so much.
Yeah, lovely, lovely thoughts for us to close this very enjoyable conversation, Alpo, with you. Thank you so much for taking part in this podcast.
Thank you, Alpo. So thank you for listening to the What Now Ludic Insights podcast. What now from you? If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel saying why this was so and what have you learned. We also appreciate hearing from you directly and having a What Now conversation in the chats. Remember, we're asking the big questions about what all of us should be doing and how we will achieve this. And what are some of the weak signals that already exist that may show the way forward? What now? If you're interested in submitting questions or topics for discussion, please do so by pinging us directly at our LinkedIn pages on the Ludic Podcast What Now page. You can also submit names of interesting people and projects that you believe we should feature. We'd be delighted if you join our conversation. Hashtag What Now Ludic Insights. What now? Subscribe today and stay tuned. See you next time.
That's a wrap for this episode of What Now, part of the Ludic Insights podcast series hosted by Paul Ashcroft and Garrick Jones. Follow hashtag What Now on Twitter and LinkedIn. Stay tuned for more and subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, CastBox, iHeart, Listen Notes, Overcast, Podchaser, and Radio Public. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and Jill Damatek-Futter and edited by Jill Damatek-Futter and Roman Pacherski.